You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture.
I was kind of stuck on the A's. I was looking at astrophysics, archaeology and architecture. When I found out you couldn't become an astronaut doing astrophysics, I thought, oh, I'll do architecture then. I graduated in 1992 and there was no work at all. And I managed to get a place in a circus for a few months. I was performing in a big top in Sheffield. I was doing juggling and trapeze and tumbling. And then when it was all over, I realised we were in the depths of the recession and I had no chance of finding any work. And I just did what lots of people did then, which is got on a bus and went abroad.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. With me, Owen Wainhouse.
I'm Annalie Riches and I'm a director at Mikael Riches.
On the programme this week is the architect Annalie Riches, one half of the multi-award-winning architecture practice Mikael Riches. The practice, founded by Annalie and her partner David Mikael, are known for their considerable track record of beautifully considered housing developments. Annalie originally studied architecture at Sheffield University before moving to Paris, where she found work at RFR, the architecture and engineering firm founded by Peter Rice, Martin Francis and Ian Ritchie. But after 2 years, Annalie returned to London to continue her studies at North London University, now the Cass School of Architecture, where she studied under Peter St John of Caruso St John Architects, who went on to win the 2016 Stirling Prize. In 1998, Annalie and two friends bought a plot of land and designed and largely self-built their own housing development at Watcott's Yard, the site of former garages in North London. The formative scheme went on to win them an RBA award and the Architects Journal First Building Award. Sometime later, in 2013, Mikael Riches won the RBA's award for London Building of the Year for their scheme at Church Walk, where the practice had also acted as client and developer. In this week's episode, we talk about learning and working in a foreign language. We find out about the challenges and rewards of architects working as developers. And we hear about the practice's plans for the renovation of the Brutalist Park Hill estate in Sheffield. I spoke to Annalie in one of their flats at Church Walk, where I started by asking when she knew she wanted to be an architect.
I think I just ended up doing architecture quite randomly, really. Neither of my parents were architects. My dad's an artist and my mum's a doctor. And I think there was always this combination of art and science. And I did my A-levels art and science. So there probably weren't that many
options.
I had no idea. I just thought it might be something I might be good at, given what I was good at.
But you must have made, so you were doing art and then what, a couple of sciences at A-level?
I did maths, physics, chemistry and art.
Right.
And I was kind of stuck on the A's. I was looking at astrophysics, archaeology and architecture.
Right.
And I ended up doing architecture.
Just opened the course directory and didn't get past page two.
When I found out you couldn't become an astronaut doing astrophysics, right, I thought, oh, I'll do architecture then. Okay. But I knew nothing about it. And I remember being asked at the interview what my favourite building was. I'm from Orpington, and I said the Walnut Sports Centre in Orpington. And I can't believe they gave me a place. I really didn't know anything about it. So not a great start, I don't think. But I went to Sheffield. I was trying to get far away from Orpington as I could.
Right.
And Sheffield was an amazing place to be a student, actually. But I don't think I shone there.
But you carried on then, almost straight away, back to London.
Well,
for part two.
When I finished, I graduated in 1992. And there was no work at all. And I managed to get a place in a circus for a few months.
doing what?
I was performing in a big top in Sheffield. I was doing juggling and trapeze and tumbling because I used to do gymnastics.
Right.
And so I spent a few months doing that. And then when it was all over, I realised we were in the depths of the recession and I had no chance of finding any work. And I just did what lots of people did then, which is got on a bus and went abroad, which sadly might not be an option for people now. And I went to Paris.
So straight up, that was after your part one?
After part one, yeah. Okay. And I ended up looking for work in Paris, walking from office to office with my portfolio.
Right.
It was really bad French, trying to get people to give me a job, and no one did.
You didn't study French at that level.
No, my French was really bad. I did O level, but I think I got to work. Eventually, I got work through a friend had a job, and she managed to get me a job in an architect's office. And it's quite different, the system in France, because architects are quite often only designed to 100 to 200, and then they hand it to the Bureau d'Etudes to take it on and detail it and produce it. So quite often what we were doing was really, really just kind of volumetric, really. So I thought I'd quite like to work for a Bureau d'Etudes and work from 100 to 200 down to 100 to 1. And the one I really wanted to work for was Peter Rice. Is off RFR in Paris, and I kept trying to get a job there by going in and trying to speak to someone, but that didn't go very well at all. And eventually, I mean, sadly, the reason they did start looking for someone was because Peter Rice had a brain tumor, and he wasn't able to look at drawings anymore, really, and he needed to look at models, so they looked for a model maker. Right. And so I managed to get that.
And that was whilst you were in Paris, that was before you came back to
your part. Yes, yeah, yeah. Okay. I was in Paris for about 4 months before I got a job at RFR.
And so, I mean, maybe just say a few words about RFR. They're kind of an engineering, or known for engineering, are they?
It is an engineering, it's called a Bureau d'Etudes, which is fundamentally engineering. They were an amazing bunch of people.
Ian Ritchie then was part of...
Yes, it was Rice Francis Ritchie. And Ian Ritchie wasn't really part of it when I was there. He'd left. And Martin Francis lived in the south of France and was designing yachts. so he wasn't really there either. But it was made up of engineers and architects.
Right.
And quite a number of people who were qualified as both.
Yeah.
And it was just a fantastic... It's a fantastic place to work because there was, I don't know, there was just so many kind of discussions and conversations about engineering and architecture together. And in France, there's a very different attitude to work. You know, you go to work and then you'll always have an hour lunch with a little carafe of wine and being with the engineers, they'd all got their pens out and draw all over the tablecloth, and it was a very kind of big part of the day going out for lunch, which doesn't seem to happen
quite.
But the whole, you know, the whole system's geared up for it because you get your ticket restaurant, and then you can go. So everyone kind of benefits from this big thing of going to lunch, and it's a shame we don't really have that. They were a very special practice, being architects and engineers working together.
Okay, that's not as kind of symptomatic of that's how architecture is done in France. That's particular to the practice.
I think it's particular to them.
Okay.
And I ended up being employed as a model maker to make these soldered brass models, which replicated the structure. So all the elements were scaled down versions of what the structure would be. Because at that time, the programs of non-linear analysis were so slow.
Yeah.
They used to get me to make these models and then prod them and see how they deflected and eventually fell to pieces as a quite, you know, good way to see how the structure would perform.
Right, okay. You were there for how long?
I stayed there for 2 years. I think...
And working in French.
In French.
So your French.
It got better and better.
Nothing like learning on the job. Yeah.
Yeah, no, my French, not, I mean, that was a long time ago. Yeah. It's still passable.
Okay.
It was very good. But I think, it's great. It's great learning another language. It wasn't something I thought I was any good at. I wasn't any good at it at school. But it's
somehow learning through doing is different from.
Yeah, it's all learned by ear, really. Yeah. So I don't. And yeah, I think it kind of. I wasn't really in much of a rush to go back to university.
Okay.
I hadn't really enjoyed the experience at all. Okay. But in the end, I realised that.
But it hadn't put you off wanting to be an architect, though. Maybe you'd have.
Well.
I mean, when you left university, did you think, that's it, I'm done with architecture? Or did you think, I want to go and do things, I want to...
I think I had a particularly rough ride at university. Okay. I managed to fail my second year. And unfairly, I believe, obviously. And was actually going to leave and not do it. I had to make a bit of a decision because I had to retake it, which was almost unheard of.
Right.
At that time, I don't even know if she put this in.
No, we can cut some of this, but I'm sort of interested. I mean, I think what's particularly interesting thing is struggling, you know, having that difficult period at university and going on to run your own award-winning practice is a real contrast to a lot of people who...
sail through and find it really easy.
Or sail through and then find, actually, practice is really difficult. You know, they've kind of been lauded, perhaps, at university with...
At that point, I didn't really want to continue, actually. But I remember my parents got me a job. It wasn't really at Richard Reed Architects.
Right.
And he was such a...
Whilst you were at university, it's kind of summer job.
Yeah, well, it was while I was having to retake the year for three months, I got this job. And he was such a... He was very generous, kind of fun, bon viveur, and... There was such a great atmosphere in the office. I started to think, you know, perhaps this might be okay after all.
For someone who's gone on to run their own practice now and such a successful practice, it's, you know, it's interesting. There was that kind of stumble maybe at university. Do you know what, I don't know enough about how architecture degrees work, but what did you fail? I mean, what was the...
Well, it was, I think I was probably being taught a lesson for having the wrong attitude. Because I didn't actually fail anything. And I don't think it's something that could happen now.
Right.
But I don't think I really kind of fitted.
Didn't fit Sheffield,
didn't,
do you think?
No, I loved Sheffield, but... Yeah, or I don't know. I mean, I was certainly not... I probably was obviously not working as hard as they thought I should.
Right.
But and I was passing... But only just, and okay. I didn't really mind that I wasn't getting really good marks.
Yeah.
And they didn't like that.
Okay.
So they made me do the whole bloody thing again. And I think actually, in retrospect, it was a very good thing because I'd always kind of, you know, been quite good at winging stuff.
Yeah.
And it made me really have to decide, you know, it... As I said, I just chanced upon architecture and then I had to make a big decision about whether or not it was what I should be doing. Yeah. And I decided I was going to come back fighting. And it was getting a reasonable mark in my degree was hard work because I was given poor marks the whole time.
Yeah.
And I got a 2-1 in the end. So that was all right.
Yeah. So it went off then, two years in Paris.
2 years in Paris, and...
Was it always, I mean, did you go to Paris with a kind of a fixed, I'll spend 2 years, or what brought you back? What brought you back to do the part two?
I think it was becoming obvious that whilst RFR were brilliant, they gave me so many kind of responsible jobs to do, and I graduated from being a model maker to making 3D computer models of all the structures, and then doing tender packages and details, and... amazing stuff they got me to do, but it became obvious that I was still a stagiaire, that I wasn't, without my diploma, I had absolutely no qualification in France because it's not even a part of their education system. And so they said, well, you know, why don't you go to a French university and do the rest of the course and you can carry on working here. And I looked at some, but I didn't really like the courses so much. And eventually... Someone in the office got Irenaeus Gulber, who teaches here, to phone me up and say, you've got to go to England and go to the University of North London in Peter St. John's unit.
Yeah.
And I did, but I didn't really know who he was or anything about him, but I just thought, well, it's quite a good lead and maybe I should just go and get my diploma.
You moved back, packed your bags, moved back to London.
Yeah, and I managed to get into the North London University for Peter St. John and Peter St. John's unit, which actually turned out to be an amazing thing. And I was probably a really awful student, very reluctant student.
Leaving your wonderful lifestyle in Paris behind.
I had my kind of confidence massively knocked, in education. Yeah, I really didn't want to go back to it. But he was a brilliant teacher. And
so maybe just say a few words about Peter St. John.
So Peter St. John was in partnership with Adam Crusoe St. John Architects, and they'd had a few projects. They'd done quite small projects, and at the time, and they were both running units at University of North London, which then became CAS.
So he was running. He was practicing and teaching at the same time, but already thought of as a bit of a luminary.
I don't think so. I mean, it was way before they won the Warsaw Art Gallery, which was their first kind of project they're really known for. So it was quite strange. I ended up there.
So you were there for, is it 2 years, the Masters, 1 year?
Yeah, I spent 2 years there, and it was brilliant, actually. And I went from, I came back from Paris being able to make models and do drawings incredibly quickly without even having to worry about it. So I was actually able to spend time doing things that are a bit more experimental and having fun casting things. And
whereas other people might have been a bit slower on the kind of practical stuff, you were just doing that.
I kind of got the hang of doing all that stuff really quickly. So I did lots of things. Yeah, it was fun. It was good. And at the end of it, I'd done quite well for, well, I don't know.
What, immediately afterwards for Edward Cullinan? Was that immediately after part two?
I think I spent a few months on the dole.
Okay. pretty convinced you were going to be an architect.
I think I'd realised I could actually be, quite good at it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the main thing, I suppose.
Did you at that stage kind of have visions of your own practice or,
When I think it took a few months to get a job, but I did get a job at Edward Cullinan Architects, which was, another great place to work. At the same time, I was in conversations with people from North London about buying a site and building some houses. So there was always that kind of ambition to go and build something. In hindsight, I'm sure it was because of, Peter St. John had built his own house, and at the time we were in the unit, Adam Crusoe was building his. So that was obviously
Everyone's kind of
inspiration, like, oh yeah, it must be easy. Everyone's doing it. All the time I was working, I was looking for plots of land in my spare time and trying to find a place that we could build a, series of houses, whether they were vertically or stacked or horizontal terraces. So that was all going on at the same time. And then eventually we found a plot at Watcott's Yard, we ended up doing as a self-build project over quite a few years, actually.
And you say we, that was you and...
Yeah, I ended up with... There was actually quite a big group, I think, initially, but everyone kind of, gradually it got down to... I did it with Sylvia Ulmea and Barty Garibaldo.
Okay. So that was the first kind of architecture's developer project you worked on. Okay.
So I think we found the plot in 1998, and we ended up moving into it in 2002.
Okay.
So it was a four-year project. So I think all the time I was at Cullinan's, I was spending all my weekends
on the side,
on my scooter, going around to garages and walking onto them and saying, "Do you want to sell?"
Right, okay.
We had no money. It was all, and we got a lead eventually from. We walked onto this garage and we said, "Do you want to sell?" And they went, "No, but we know someone who's got a site," and they gave me a number to phone. Right. And I phoned up and they did have a site, and it wasn't on the market.
So what, some old garages?
It was a backland site. It was used to be for storing trucks. It was just right. a storage.
So no planning permission, but you
planning permission for a kind of shed on it, but right. not residential. And it wasn't on the market. And we managed to persuade them to sign a contract subject right. to planning permission, so we could have a go at getting planning permission yeah. For 6 months. And we didn't get planning in the 6 months.
Right.
But we got refused for reasons which weren't change of use. Okay. And so we thought, oh, we can build something here. So we yeah. ended up buying it.
Anyway,
yeah. which felt like a massive risk
yeah.
it was at the time.
So you thought otherwise you might get some commercial... or something.
Well, we hadn't been refused for change of use. We'd been refused right. for overshadowing and right. various other okay. things. So we just okay. thought, if we can get a residential project on here, yeah. then okay. we can do something. Okay. And yeah, so then I think it took us another year to get a planning permission on it, and then another year to find anyone who'd lend us any money to yeah. build it, because it was massively risky because we were all sharing foundations and. It wasn't the normal self-build mortgage kind of offer. Yeah. And then we were building it for 2 years. So we all
actually doing some of the building yourself.
We all gave up our day jobs for a year and went on the tools.
Wow.
And did okay. built not particularly well. quite a lot of it. I mean, not all of it. Yeah. We also acted as main contractors, so we subcontracted the foundations and structures okay. and glazing, and then I did all the plumbing and electrics, and
that's quite
plasterboarding and things
novel,
like that.
Do you think? I mean, there's something about architects, particularly maybe in architectural education, about architects not getting their hands dirty on site. Do you think that's unusual?
I think the building
yourself, I mean, kind of having that experience of materials and finishing and actually
I think
plumbing.
It's a really good lesson, just, you know, trying to put up plasterboarding and
yeah.
all of that is brilliant. And I decided to do the bits that weren't really visible because I wasn't sure I'd be very good at finished joinery. So right. I did the stuff, all the stuff that was behind the walls, like the plumbing and electrics yeah. and I installed the boiler. Probably wow. shouldn't have done most of it, but I used Colin's DIY manual mostly,
right.
Which was a brilliant, yeah. brilliant book for most things.
Colin's DIY manual.
Colin's yeah. DIY manual. You can actually build a house from it.
Yeah. But we've talked before, I guess. Church Walk was another of your architectures developer projects.
Yes, but not building.
No, you weren't doing the building.
Someone else
no.
to do the building.
But you had the interest there in
yeah.
all along. We might.
I think that it was Watcott's Yard. I probably wouldn't yeah. have... We probably wouldn't have done this unless we'd have had that experience and known it was okay, really.
Yeah, okay. So we'll come on to Church Walk when we've kind of gone on to the practice. But so then you worked for Robert Dye Associates for a while?
Yeah, I worked for Robert Dye while I was doing all the, I suppose, you know, trying to get planning and everything yeah. on the... And that's... I gave that up to start building.
Okay.
And that was, it was kind of great experience. Again, it was a lot of small residential projects where you work from, you know, planning through to details
yeah.
and they're brilliant projects to learn the whole kind of craft of and see what you have drawn, built quite quickly, yeah. actually.
And it's very much kind of housing that's been your interest, your kind of speciality. You think certainly the practice now is a lot of housing.
Yeah, it's always been an interest. And I think, well, we set up Richard Horney Mikkel Architects specifically to get involved with housing.
Okay.
And we really wanted to get involved with social housing. And that was bringing together, you know, an old friend, Kathy Hawley, who we were I was at Sheffield with, and
so you knew her from university.
Yeah, we were at university together, and David Mikkel, who he had his own practice, David Mikkel Architects.
Yeah,
and trying to kind of pool resources and different experiences to try and get involved with housing.
So how did you first meet David then? Where did that, was that from Sheffield?
No. No, he had a practice in the same building as Robert Dye Associates.
Okay, so you met whilst you were working.
Okay. Pre-work. Difficult architects, isn't it? Okay. don't get out much.
Long hours. So you met David there, and your partners, both in the business and outside the business, in life, as it were. Okay, that's a number of, I mean, I was talking to, as I say, to Patty Hopkins about setting up their husband and wife practice in Hopkins Architects. Slightly more complicated, I guess, having three directors, having Kathy as a director. Is that, I mean, I guess it's quite interesting for people outside of architecture to think about working, running a business with a partner in terms of sharing creative ideas, quite an interesting, I'm kind of, I guess, interested in what brings.
It's probably not an easy dynamic. I mean, I think in retrospect, I try to be kind of, you know, not talk about anything outside work, because otherwise it wouldn't be fair on Kathy. Yeah. She would miss out.
Yeah.
But inevitably it happens, and it's hard. And I think you know, it was a really great, you know, we did really brilliant work together, actually. Yeah. I think we were quite good, as we're quite different personalities, but we, you know, did projects I'm really proud of, like Clayfield in Suffolk, which was our first housing project.
Right.
And I think the business really kind of suffered when the last kind of the credit crunch happened, and all of our work was actually outside London.
Right.
And nothing, we had nothing in London. It was only London that was kind of sustaining people.
Yeah.
Actually, we had Brentford. Brentford was Lockwest. But apart from that, you know, we had lots of projects. We had brilliant projects in kind of Manchester and Liverpool and Norwich and Suffolk. And inevitably the practice couldn't really continue.
Right. So you reformed, and that was when you reformed as Mikkel Richies.
Yes, I mean, David Mikkel Architects changed its name to Mikkel Richies.
Okay.
And I think with a kind of different economic cycle, we were able to, you know, start to build that up again.
Okay.
I think at the beginning.
So what sort of size was it? I mean, when you, was David Mikkel Architects, what sort of size practice?
David Mikkel Architects always been about kind of 3-4 people. Okay. But actually, so was Rich Swanamy. I think we, you know, grew to maybe 6 or 7 at the largest. In fact, we did share quite a lot of resources. We had the same phone line, but with a different ring for the two different practices. So we were all in the same room, and that, you know, we could kind of swap staff when we needed to. But I think the difference was the different type of work that David Mikkel Architects was doing, because it was small residential work, which actually in London, which actually could continue on in that time.
So what sort of size is the practice now?
We're 15.
Okay. And that's the biggest you've been as a practice?
I think we've been 20.
Okay.
It's quite a nice number, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
Between 15 and 20 is quite a nice number, I think.
I think a lot of people say that, do you like, I guess above that you start to lose track of what individuals are doing in the practice? And
I mean, I don't know, because we've not reached those giddy heights yet.
But you like to be, I mean, I guess you like to be involved in the projects. You're kind of an active director, are you, in the practice?
Yeah, I really like to be involved. And also I really like things like, I like detailing, and I like how materials go together and nuts and bolts. And I guess if we grew much bigger, it wouldn't be something that I'd be able to look through all the details.
Okay. So you lose that enjoyment of...
But it would probably be something different. Yeah. So,
And then I was kind of interested in the kind of award winning. So we're in Church Walk now, which won a REBA award in 2013, won Reba London's Building of the Year award, which is a real, I mean, up against all sorts of things in London.
So, that was a real surprise. Nice.
Right. Yeah. But you must have sensed there was something special about the building, did you, when it was going up?
It's a really funny project because we bought it at auction. We bought the site at auction. It was, I know lots of architects who said they looked at it and
figure out what to do with it.
Like, right. Just kind of, which is, and how surprised when they come in. But it was a project that we just thought, oh, let's do it. We've had the experience at Walcott's Yard. We could, maybe this is our pension. Neither of us have pensions. So we could just kind of carry on working it. And the more we drew it, the more we really got quite excited about it and thought, oh. And so it got to the point where we thought, oh, well, we've got to go and live in it now. Yeah. We can't just do it and not live in it. So now we've lived in two of them.
Right. So there's four units here then.
There's four units.
Okay.
And
maybe just say, just for people who aren't familiar, just say a few words about it.
So it's a really kind of overlooked site, quite overshadowed actually. We're about a metre away from the site's about a metre away from our neighbour at one point.
Okay.
And it's four units and they step up. There are three bedroom units and then the highest one is above a one bedroom flat.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a ziggurat.
Yeah.
And that form is really all about daylight and overshadowing to neighbours. So it's the BRE daylight guideline just made into a kind of solid envelope and then divided up. But I think when we were doing it, it's quite funny when you're stuck in a project, you don't really think, oh, it's going to win loads of awards or anything. You're just trying to make it the best
it can be. Do people not think that? When they're doing their own, I guess that must be the difficult thing when you're acting as a developer, is knowing how much effort and money, I guess, to throw at the project without bankrupting yourself in order to kind of create something that's...
Yeah. I really liked being able to make those decisions on what was worth spending money on and what wasn't.
Right.
We haven't got it completely right. We bought really cheap taps and we've had to replace them all and shower screens and the things that, at the end when you've literally got no money, but making decisions about Duggars fir skirtings or things that, developer would never, they don't cost that much more money, but I think the quality they add is quite a lot more. So being in control of those decisions is brilliant. And then, of course, we have to, if we made the wrong decision, it's our fault and we have to pay for it. maybe there should be more of a way that architects can develop and take a bit more risk and reward.
But do you think that gives you then a kind of advantage over other practices that you've kind of, I guess, developers are always just arguing, I guess a lot of developers just for kind of cheaper, value engineering things out. But do you think that kind of insight into having done it yourself changes the way you work with other, because a lot of the work you do, there's a few kind of projects we might talk about, some of the kind of passive house projects, is it Goldsmith Street in Norwich and a few other social housing projects where there can't be a lot of money to throw at the project. So lots had to be done on pretty tight budgets, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think it's really important to know where it's worth spending money and where it isn't. And I guess you don't always win those arguments with clients, but you do your best. I think maybe architects have got quite a bad image, or people think that they're just kind of going off on some flight of fancy and not rooted in the kind of practicalities of money. And but certainly I think it doesn't take that much money to turn something into something extraordinary.
Right.
And that's why I do really enjoy doing social housing or housing without that much money, because I think you can make quite a lot out of a lot less.
Do you think there's, thinking about where people spend the money, I just wondering, are there things that you might keep in that architects would appreciate looking at a house versus things that non-architects might appreciate?
I think it's quite interesting working on, I've worked on really, high-end housing and social housing, and And, you know, things people want aren't that dissimilar. I think one of the big differences is the kind of open plan living room.
Yeah.
You know, if people have got, like, lots of kids, they just want to shut the door and have it separate. And so there are some differences, but, you know, just kind of universal things like people want to feel safe and they want great light and views where they have. And, you know, there's universal things that people want. Loads of storage and thought through kitchens and I don't know.
But I'm just kind of wondering, yeah, those things like whether people are able, people buying houses are able to kind of articulate that in a sense, yeah, that you might know it. If you're not an architect, you might know it feels like a nice space. But I guess when people are looking for houses, whether they, I'm just wondering about the kind of, how people buy houses in Britain and whether, I mean, I guess you've had a living in Paris and kind of more apartment living. Is there anything there about?
I don't think people have much choice, do they, here? I don't think there's much on offer apart from pretty standard stuff that people know. No one's really prepared to take that many risks with in housing.
No.
There are a few really great clients out there who know that design sells, and that's why they carry on, you know, doing projects like we're working with Urban Splash. They know that there's a value to great design and people really want it. Where it's, that, you know, but volume house builders will probably just go for something they've sold previously.
Yeah. I just kind of just think maybe it must be really frustrating when you spend your whole kind of professional life thinking, really. I mean, that's what architecture is, thinking about how people live and how people kind of experience their houses, particularly to kind of see people living with kind of lots of clutter or lots of stuff or kind of...
I think if people have... I don't know. I mean, I suppose I get more frustrated by the kind of cookie-cutter housing that's going up with no space outside it, really, for things like, you know, play, things that make communities. There's a load of really awful housing going up around the country. We know who they are.
Today, Noel,
And that really depresses me because, I mean, I think in a house you have the option of changing it, don't you? Really, you can change the kitchen, you can knock walls down, you have that ability if you own it.
Yeah.
Whereas the outside and public realm and what I get more upset by.
And do you find, I mean, okay, moving around London, do you find yourself getting... politics is one of the things I come back to on a number of these kind of podcasts about how kind of exercise people get about what's around them and what's being done.
Oh, I think it's quite depressing times at the moment, isn't it? I'm trying not to.
Sorry,
it's Christmas.
Coming back to, okay. Happy thoughts.
But it's true. Do you know, I just think that people can't see the value in creative thinking.
Yeah.
That it's probably... relatively unusual mindset for most of the people involved in actually kind of delivering housing, and no one can see the value. So I get frustrated when we're the last people anyone talks to. You know, they've developed a brief, they've done a crappy master plan, and they need someone to dress a box, and that's their impression of what architects can do for them. And it's so far from
the truth.
And you know, really, we could be there at the beginning of the conversation. We could save people a lot of money, I think. Yeah. Actually, we know how to save money and make things, don't know.
Yeah. So coming back to, I mean, actually kind of talking about housing in that way and the way people live, Park Hill is the big project which you're working on at the moment.
Yes.
So Park Hill in Sheffield, a big... 1960s?
Yeah, early. It was finished in 1961, I think.
Okay. Described, I guess, at the time, sink estate, people might say.
Well,
at the time.
It wasn't when it was first built. It was actually a kind of, you know, brave new world for people who'd had no toilets. And it had lots of quite incredible things about it, you know, like district heating, underfloor heating.
Yeah.
Waste disposal. Okay. We found evidence of underfloor heating pipes in the screed.
Wow. Okay.
So it's a really fascinating project just to kind of look at and study. And obviously being at Sheffield University, it was it's quite an in-your-face building.
It's up on a hill above
the station. The okay. And you can't miss it, really. Okay. It's a
kind of present for some time. Yeah.
So
Hawkins Brown, then, just by way of kind of for people listening, Hawkins Brown won phase one of the renovation. And they were Sterling shortlisted.
Sterling shortlisted, yeah.
When was that? A couple of years ago. But then you won fairly hefty competition, some other big names. When was that? That was relatively recently.
That was 2 years ago.
Right, okay. So a big win for the practice.
It was a big win, another competition, but probably the most fun one we've ever done.
Okay.
Because
and have competitions been a big part of the practice? I mean,
yeah, we get nearly all our work in competition.
Right. Work that you don't commission for yourself, you do a lot in competition.
Okay. Yeah, which probably isn't the best business model. I mean, you know, they're a lot of work.
And yeah.
There's no point doing them unless you're really out to win it. So, yeah. But this was a really fun competition because there wasn't that much of a brief. They wanted a different approach. They wanted something maybe lighter touch, and they gave us a flat. 2 weeks.
Right.
And we had 2 weeks to do it as well, which is brilliant because there's not that much you can do in 2 weeks in a flat in Sheffield. It's only open in site hours. And we did we drew all over the walls.
Right. You in the practice.
We went in kind of these Tyvek boiler suits with spray paint, and we drew our scheme on the on the walls in 4 hours. It was it was quite stressful. And we thought everyone was going to do that because it felt like it was a no-brainer.
This was the competition.
Right. And so the competition, the interview was inviting everyone into our flat and showing them our flat.
Wow. So this was Urban Splash.
This was their idea.
Right.
And they took on, it was actually a very brave thing. The reason Park Hill wasn't demolished was because it was listed.
Right.
And they'd already demolished the two other big housing projects in Sheffield, and probably, I reckon Park Hill was probably next, and Historic England, or English Heritage then, listed it.
Okay, listed.
And, you know, I mean, there's various examples of listed buildings that nothing happens to, like the Cardiff Seminary. But here, Urban Splash took it on. It's vast. It's 1,000 flats.
Wow.
And so that's, you know, effectively they took on the regeneration of it.
Right.
And it's a massive project.
And interesting, I mean, how regeneration has become a kind of difficult word, I guess, in London. Are there the same issues in Sheffield?
There's definitely the same issues. I mean, it was 100% social housing. Now it's going to be, I think, 25% social housing. I mean, people would say it was gentrification. I think we need to build more social housing.
Yeah.
I mean, whether or not it's a good decision to have 1,000 social housing units in one block.
Yeah.
Pretty isolated from Sheffield.
Yeah. Altogether.
But
that's how it was. Yeah. Okay, and then another Vela City, is that slightly more recent? Did that?
I think we won that, was it 2 weeks ago?
A competition again?
Another competition, yeah.
Okay.
Which is, it's an ideas competition. I don't think there's a job at the end of it, but it was a competition to have ideas about the Oxford to Cambridge corridor and how to put new houses and new places there that people actually want to live in. And this is going alongside the new infrastructure. So there's a, you know, proposed line between Oxford and Cambridge.
It's famously difficult at the moment to travel between the two.
Yeah, I think you have to come to London on the tube and then off again. That's the quickest way. And it's kind of choked with traffic as well.
Yeah.
And that seemed like a really good opportunity to put together a team of people that I've met through Padel, which is the all-women's cycling.
Yeah. Okay. There's a theme here. I mean, I've spoken to Mary Duggan, Sadie Morgan a little while ago, kind of theme of people you met through the
Yeah, I think that a lot of I don't know, networking goes on between men on golf courses, women don't really have that same same thing, I don't think. Yeah. And so Jennifer Ross and Claire Trenner set up Padel.
Yeah.
I think 5 years ago to get women cycling, very amateurly. I think 300 miles in 3 days. So I did.
Doesn't sound that amateur, but yeah, 300 miles in
3 days. And I've done 4 out of 5, and that's it.
Okay, you finished.
Okay. So I think when, and it's actually not an easy ride. I think this year was really tough.
But you are an urban cyclist as well. That means you're a little Brompton down.
That's
the,
my.
Yeah. Is that a recent thing, the cycling? Is that something you've always been?
I think because I've always for years lived in Stoke Newington, it kind of is the only way to get out, except for the 73 bus, which. So I've.
Because you're kind of in between a lot of different overground kind of tube, is not amazingly.
Yeah,
close.
It's
so
not.
So the bike becomes the.
So
kind of,
I think it's been my. But, you know, before I'd done it, I don't think I'd ever cycle more than 6 miles.
Right.
Before starting to train for Padel.
Okay. And is that the kind of Velocity cycling ideas come out of that? As a sort of, I mean, thinking about cycling in the city and cycling kind of ideas.
I think when you cycle, you just realise actually how close things are. And you can always be on time when you cycle. Yeah. You're never late. And I hate being late. So I always get everywhere hours early because something might happen on the bus. So cycling is a really good way to just be incredibly efficient on time.
Yeah.
And then you realise how close things are and how connected things are, which you don't if you don't cycle.
No. Okay. So you've now moved out of London. You talked a little bit about some work in Suffolk. And you're living now in...
Just moved to Whitstable.
Right,
It's probably the wrong time for you to be there.
So you've been interested really in some of that kind of, am I right, a few projects in East Anglia and a few projects in that?
Yeah, we've got...
Just kind of wondering whether that's a theme anywhere or whether it's just kind of more open attitude to housing maybe or...
I think because, you know... When we were Richard Hawley Mickow, we had no projects in London. We had lots of projects outside London. We're really keen on working outside London, actually. Yeah. It's really enjoyable. There's a slightly different attitude, I think.
Yeah.
And so in Norwich, we're doing this social... It's 100% social housing,
this
actually.
Is the,
social rent.
Goldsmith Street.
Yes, passive house.
And passive house is not, I mean... Not normally associated with social housing, I guess, because of cost or because of... But this is 100% social.
It's 100% social rent and passive house. And then we've got another project in Devon and project in Sheffield. So so we're...
diversifying across the country.
Yeah. I think...
But do you think that's, I guess you kind of alluded to Brexit kind of earlier on. Is that a sensible, do you kind of pick up that maybe things are going on with the London market, do you think?
Oh, I think I just benefited so much from, you know, personally. So, yeah. I mean, the fact that it's not just about people coming here, it's about our ability to be able to go and find work. And, you know, I did it and... I count myself very lucky as having been able to find work in another country, but certainly in my year at university, people went to Berlin, you know, several people went to Berlin.
I was talking to Alison Brooks about, you know, during the crashes, actually a number of practices about British architects moving to Germany in the 90s.
Yeah.
Because there was no work here and setting up. And
so, we're just stuck on this island now.
Yeah. And interesting, having spent a couple of years in France, your work is still UK-based predominantly. You've not really pushed for kind of international... Is that just family commitments here and difficult for travelling, or what's the... is that I a future really, for the practice for international work, do you think?
I'd really love to work in Europe, actually. I do think, having lived in France and speaking French, I do feel like I'm a bit European, so more than British, maybe. So that would be great. I think we've, I think what we've been doing over the past few years is kind of building up a portfolio of work, and kind of after the last slump, just kind of building ourselves up.
And then future for the practice. Have you got a 10-year plan for the practice? What's the you're just enjoying it as it comes?
I think my problem is I never have a 10-year plan for anything. Okay. So it's...
there's nothing wrong with that, you know. You shouldn't have to.
Personally, I'm just happy having great projects for great clients and doing them really well and being proud of them,
and winning awards for them. The practice will stay principally, I mean, your real interest is still on housing. You're not thinking about kind of branching into other fields.
I love doing housing. If I was going to be kind of in a sector, that's what I would choose. But I would... kind of we're in housing quite accidentally, really.
Right.
And I think I would like to do something else as well.
I suppose once you get a track record and you get a name for yourself,
I think you also get pigeonholed. And it's almost easier to reinvent yourself than to try and change people's perceptions of you. So I think Velo City is quite interesting, because having kind of got the team together and you know, actually it's not housing, it's a different kind of idea. It's a bigger, it's more strategic thinking. I've really enjoyed doing that.
There may be more of those kind of collaborations and thinking for competitions.
I like collaborating.
And then maybe just kind of rounding up, thinking about inspiration. Kind of interested in things maybe around London you found inspiring, maybe, or... You talked about what was that question, the university question about your favourite building. Your favourite building is presumably not still the Leisure Centre in Orpington.
No. But at least it's not... do you know what? I find this quite a hard question, because I think rather than being influenced by a specific thing, I'm influenced more by bits and pieces of things that I see.
Yeah.
So... I'd find it very hard to say there's the one thing that I'm...
Presumably everyone's... I mean, maybe this is wrong, I don't know, but everyone's architectural style is, I guess, picked up from others, partly from people you've worked with or things you've seen.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you're kind of completely influenced by everything you see.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe the kind of influence between your and David's architectural styles or architectural approaches the same? Are you...
I think...
Having different architectural approaches, does that...
I think we probably have quite similar approaches. I think we're good at different things, which is quite good.
Yeah.
So the bits where I kind of flag and can't do, then he'll pick up. So we're definitely... Whenever we do a project, it's always much stronger if we're both working on it, even if we're doing different bits of it.
Yeah,
I think I like the kind of more strategic stuff and then the detail. I love how things are put together and the kind of drawings you have to do to describe them to other people to tell them how to build it. And I think that's really... So I had that kind of education in my year out.
Yeah. Quite a different
That was really lucky, and I think it's really great to get experience outside what you do and learn a different kind of aspect of architecture. I think it was RFR was a very special place, actually, so it was just an amazing combination of architecture and engineering, and I think the art of the detail was something that was really important. But I think people coming out now, it's probably maybe the way that the industry's working. There's a lot of design and build projects. Maybe people aren't getting that experience detailing. And maybe people think maybe it's the not so exciting and important bit of architecture.
Am I right thinking you've done a bit of lecturing at universities. You've done a bit of... Am I mistaken? Has David done some? Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
I've done some lectures. I've done some teaching, yeah. I did teaching with Kathy. Kathy and I had a unit at Kingston for a couple of years, and she's still there.
What were you teaching? What was the...
We were teaching in diploma, running a unit together. Okay. And now she's there teaching with Hugh Strange, and they've got the unit.
Right, okay. Did you enjoy the teaching?
I did enjoy it. I find it very all-consuming, though. I'd go home and kind of worry about people. Right. Worry about what, you know, why they weren't able, you know. It's very hard to go and do it as a, you know, you're paid for a day or something. Yeah. It's very hard to just do that and not take it away with you.
Your whole life thinking about...
So, I mean, there are some amazing practitioners who teach. I mean, Peter St. John's still teaching and is incredibly dedicated. Yeah. I really enjoyed it, but I can't do it at the moment. No. I haven't got time. No.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was the architect Anna Lee Richies. You can find out more about Anna Lee and her work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, as this helps others to discover the programme. You've been listening to Architecture Masters with me, Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.